Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Psychic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. Quatrième épisode, conférence de Duncan Iveson, Liberty as a Political Value.
Traveling from Australia, you can't help but think that philosophy is a journey of one kind or another. Daniel was my tutor in 231D in 1986, my first teacher of philosophy. And the whole idea of thinking about liberty as a political value started in the honor seminar that Jim and Chuck taught in 1986, where we were reading Sources of the Self in draft. And I had we did a seminar on conceptions of freedom in the 17th century, and the discussion revolved around the connection between freedom and agency. And the kernel of that idea became a PhD thesis, which became subsequently a book. And here I find myself today very strangely talking about it back in Montreal. So it is a strange but wonderful moment. So what I wanted to do was really just pick up on Daniel's where Daniel left off. And the idea behind the paper, or the thought rather than a paper, is thinking about liberty as a political value, and I guess thinking about it in non-ideal terms, as Daniel said. I mean, I think to a certain extent political philosophers just are non-ideal theorists. That's what it means in part to be a political theorist. But I'm interested in thinking about the concept of liberty in relation to quite specific concepts that are sort of tools of trade in political theory, as it were, which are concepts of power and authority and legitimacy. And I think one place to start in thinking about liberty as a political concept and political value, and I'll try and elaborate that, is really, I guess, with Rousseau. How can we both be free and forced to conform to the wills which are not our own? You know, how can we be free and yet subject to coercion? How can we be both agents and subjects simultaneously? And there's at least four answers to that. There's Rousseau's answer, right? We obey only those laws of which we are the author. There's Locke's answer, right, which is, we are able to be free when we live in a political order that respects our rights. But then there are two other answers, and I think Jim's work in particular has been really important and deserves more elaboration. And one of those answers is thinking about freedom as a practice, or liberty as a practice. I want to spend most of my time talking about that. But another answer is provided by another sort of migrant, sort of Australian, Philip Pettit, which is this idea of freedom as non-domination. A conception he's developed in part, in large part, through the work of Quentin Skinner. And one thing I want to do is bring these two conceptions together into a kind of dialogue, this idea of freedom as non-domination and this idea of freedom as practice. And I guess the punchline is, I think these are two concepts of freedom understood as political values in the quintessential sense, and useful and interesting to think about for precisely those purposes. Okay, so as I understand it, just as a very general claim, what's interesting about, I think, these two conceptions of freedom, freedom as non-domination and freedom as practice, or liberty as practice, is that both orient us around the idea of freedom as something that enables us to be a particular kind of agent, because both, I think, reject thinking of freedom in essentially causal terms, or in terms of the condition of my will. They both keep freedom closely related to concepts of power. And I think that's really important if we want to think about freedom in this political way, in this non-ideal way, as Daniel said. And I'll try and say a bit more about that in a moment. Okay, so like I said, I think Rousseau's question, or Rousseau's problem, with which I began, really captures very clearly the demands of articulating this political conception of freedom. And recall that for Rousseau, and I think this is what we talked about in that seminar in 1986, politics is fundamentally relational and transformative. It involves self-realization through the participation with others. But unlike Kant and Hegel, for Rousseau, the political order is legitimate to the extent that it reflects the general will of all, not that it accords with some a priori or regulative principle of reason. And I see the political legitimacy problem as one in which we're concerned with how people actually relate to the political order under which and through which they live, and also through which goods like social justice are delivered. So I think it's important in thinking about freedom in this political way to sort of separate the legitimacy question from the justice question. And I think there is something to Daniel's rather throwaway line that we're at a point where the orientation in political philosophy is sort of towards this freedom-centered approach as opposed to the justice-centered approach that's dominated so much Anglo-American philosophy for so long. And political legitimacy then pertains to how the coercive imposition of that order relates to the people on whom it's imposed. That's not to say that legitimacy doesn't have normative content, and I think that's important to recognize, but it's thinner, more minimal than the sort of justice relationship that we have with a social and political order. And I'll come back to this point at the very end. Now, just as an aside, why maintain this distinction? Well, one thing I've been interested in over the years, and again, everything I think I've learned that's worthwhile, I really have learned from Jim in so many ways, is if we want to take seriously the sort of consequences of the legacies of historical injustice, then we need to pay attention to that legitimacy relation, the way in which people relate to a social and political order. There are these, what Jeff Spinner-Halevis called these enduring injustices that I think we have to make sense of philosophically in some way. And listening to Cressida, it reminded me of the first time I gave a talk on historical injustice. One of my supervisors said, well, look, colonialism is, we'll just treat it like a snowstorm, right? Bad stuff happens and you compensate people for it. But you don't really ask why it happened or what the reasons are for it. You focus on the disadvantage. And I remember just being really depressed, actually, for about a week after that seminar. But it sort of resulted in another project that eventually emerged. I mean, one thought I had was, well, colonialism doesn't melt like snow. That's one big difference. So I think it's important to pay attention to this legitimacy problem. And once again, the key question here is, can the state and other agents exercise power over citizens without dominating them in the face of historical legacies, in the face of the extraordinary relations of power which people exist within? And then how do we conceive of the kind of liberty individuals and groups can exercise in those contexts? And here's where I think both Pettit and Jim's work is interesting and I think deserve to be sort of joined together in conversation more frequently than they have done. Both of them, for example, are arguing for a more democratically centered and open-ended approach to this question of political legitimacy, as I've called it, albeit for different reasons. And they both recognize, I think, the extent to which these different elements of justice and freedom exist in a kind of uneasy alliance. It's not that one takes priority over the other, but we need to see them in a more critical relation than perhaps has been the case until recently. So I think it's important to bring these two traditions of thinking about freedom together in some kind of critical dialogue. However, I think where Jim's work is interesting and useful and deserves to be developed is that against the kind of line that Pettit wants to run, and for those of you who are familiar with his work, you'll know that the basic idea is that I'm free to the extent that no one can arbitrarily interfere with me or potentially could arbitrarily interfere with me. That's very important. It's not just actual interference, but potential interference that renders me unfree. Although I think that's a powerful concept of freedom, right? It gives us a way of analyzing situations in which I might not be physically interfered with, but still unfree, and that's, I think, the power of that Republican conception. I think what makes Jim's suggestion of liberty of practice so interesting is Philip also thinks that there's no loss of liberty in a society in which you enjoy non-domination. I just think that's not quite right, and I think this concept of liberty as practice gives us a critical foil with which to engage with this idea of freedom as non-domination. So I think freedom as non-domination and liberty as practice have an interesting critical dialogue or relation to each other. Now let me just say one thing more about this idea of grasping liberty as a political value. And part of what I'm getting at here is seeing it in the context of this emergence of non-ideal theory and, to a certain extent, what has been referred to as political realism. And what I take to be one of the important, I guess, themes emerging from that literature is the extent to which any genuinely political approach to a concept or a set of conception is one which puts power and disagreement in the forefront of our analyses and our thinking through the various questions that emerge. And I think that's absolutely right. Putting it another way, Bernard Williams, for example, has distinguished between what he calls an enactment and structural approach to political theory. According to the first, the enactment theory, the whole point of political theory is to formulate principles and ideals that are then expressed in political action. According to the second, the structural approach, we lay down the moral conditions in which the coercive power of the state can be exercised and run our sort of theoretical machinery through that. In both cases, Williams' point, to cut a long story short, is that the moral is taken to be prior to the political. And this distinction, I think, mirrors the one that Daniel started with between ideal and non-ideal theory. And I think what Williams is suggesting, and I think, again, this is something implicit in Jim's work and deserves more analysis and development, I think the idea that's at work here is a kind of inversion of the priority assumption between ideal and non-ideal theory that we see in a lot of, or until recently, in a lot of contemporary political theory. So in other words, we should see perhaps non-ideal theory as a kind of anticipation of potential idea theories, or as a provisional, defeasible set of norms that we can test. So although sometimes realism is taken as eschewing any role of ideals or norms in politics altogether, I don't think that's quite right. I mean, even Williams, for example, has a fair amount of normative content in his conception of legitimacy. Okay, so having sort of raced through that, then, well, what then would be an appropriately realistic or political conception of liberty? Having sort of given you a sort of a short mug's case for why it's important and suggested that this idea of freedom as practice and freedom as non-domination is providing two potential candidates for that kind of approach, what does this conception of freedom actually end up looking like? And as I said, I think this is something that is deserving of a lot more critical attention in Jim's work, and something that is there in the work and deserves to be made perhaps more explicit. Well, it might be tempting on this whole analysis just to sort of bite the bullet and say that we sort of simply dispense with the illusion of political liberty altogether, to treat it as, you know, nothing more than a kind of empirical claim, in like describing an organism in a biological system or something. But, you know, there are three reasons why I think that's not a good idea. I mean, first of all, it's just difficult to avoid, I have to say this with Charles Taylor sitting in the room, it's just difficult to avoid evaluative language when we're grasping and interpreting our political concepts. It's just woven so deep into our discursive and political practices. And indeed, the desire for a more realistic and political conception of liberty is itself, after all, motivated by certain kinds of normative and indeed moral concerns. Secondly, even if we think we could do without the fiction of political liberty, then we'd still be left with the question of making sense of what it would mean to never resent or want to resist forces that frustrate our desires and projects and values in all kinds of way. And I think it's very hard to make sense of what that world would look like. And finally, central to just about any forms of politics, I think, is the notion that legitimate power just isn't effective power. In other words, that there's always the need for some kind of legitimation story, although, of course, not necessarily the same story in every context. However great the range of disagreement and variation around legitimation stories, our engagement in various collective social and political practices almost always includes the possibility of taking a critical stance towards those stories which to which we're subject and in which we participate. Okay, so again, what I'm sort of delaying, it's sort of the great reveal, you know, I'm delaying, what is the best way of characterizing this kind of liberty? Well, that's in the paper, it's much longer and I can't talk about it now. Now, obviously Foucault looms large in Jim's work, and people will know that for Foucault, I'm free to the extent that I possess the actual capacities and self-understandings to act on those relations of power acting on me. And of course, those capacities and self-understandings are themselves the product of various practices and relations of power in which I'm already implicated and can never stand wholly free of. And that leads to all the familiar critiques, which I won't go to in here. But as I said at the beginning, the kind of agency that Foucault and Tully are interested in is not causal, but historical. So this practice conception of freedom is, in one way, what I take to be a radical version of what Ian Carter has called the specific freedom thesis. That is, we're not to think of freedom as being free as such, being free in general, but or in some non-specific sense. We're always free to do a particular thing, being free to pursue particular ends. So I think it's more interesting, rather than pursuing the sort of normal critiques at this stage, and I'm coming to a conclusion, I think it's more interesting to bring Tully's and, to a certain extent, Foucault's conception of freedom of practice to bear on other conceptions of freedom in literature, and especially the Republican conception of freedom, to try and tease out what this conception really commits us to. They both provide, I think, a fresh perspective on established conventions for thinking about freedom. For Jim, the very capacity to test the acceptability of a norm to which we're subject, to negotiate what would count as following the norm, and then to be able to modify it, etc., is internal to the practice of following norms in the first place. Now, what's interesting is upshot of that claim for someone like Pettit's theory is that there's no real way of neutralizing once and for all the sort of arbitrariness-busting mechanisms of Republican law. Any social and political order involves relations of power acting on the actions of those subject to it in ways that could be potentially dominating. So despite the Republicans' attempt to neutralize arbitrary interference, the liberty of practice view suggests that that's rather forlorn. Of course, both then refer to certain kinds of contestatory democratic or constituent power type solutions to those problems. But I think each reflects interestingly on the potential weakness of the other. So to conclude, I think in bringing these two conceptions of what I'm calling a political, a sort of political conception of liberty together, on the one hand, the liberty as practice view helps us understand the extent to which it's very difficult to ever step outside completely the potential arbitrary shaping forces within which we're meshed. But on the other hand, the Republicans' focus on which forms of constraint, which kinds of interference are dominating or non-dominating, is something that the freedom of practice, I think, conception could well engage with. So at the end of the day, we're left, I think, with two very attractive models. One that gives us an ideal and a conception of non-domination that provides an interesting alternative to the sort of justice-oriented focus of recent political theory. And on the other hand, liberty of practice, we have an interesting ethos of critical reflection with which to reflect on that Republican norm. Thank you.